Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might also know me as the broth lady or the inventor of the hashtag more vegetables than a vegetarian. I'm the co-author of several paleo cookbooks, including Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, Real Life Paleo. I like to talk about health at any size and self-love and personal acceptance. Specifically, I have a love for lifting heavy things. If you're interested in finding more out about that, you can also find me on Strong Woman Radio.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, the PaleoMom.com. I'm the New York Times best-selling author of The Paleo Approach and The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm passionate about nutrient density and the intersection of diet and lifestyle with health, which really means I just love talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip. My name is Stacey, and I have jet lag.
Did you have an amazing trip, though?
Yes, I had an amazing trip, and now I'm exhausted.
When did you get in?
So it was 4 a.m. Rome time on Monday morning, but it was like 8 p.m. Sunday evening U.S. time, and so I just like basically skipped a night of sleep because the plane was flying back in daylight the whole time. My body does not sleep when there's daylight. So I didn't work on Monday and just rested and slept the whole day. And I actually felt really good this morning and was productive at work and clear-headed and everything was fine. And then as soon as I got home, I was like, wah, wah. Like, I'm so ready for bed. Because technically on Rome time, it's like 3 a.m. You know, right. So like, yeah, still on the struggle bus.
Your body says, sleepy sleep time.
Yeah.
Eyes no longer open. What happens to me when I get that tired is my body temperature just starts dropping anyway. It's like
I literally have a blanket wrapped around me right now.
I start freezing, and it's like my body's like, F you, Sarah. We are just going to drop our body temperature like we do when we're asleep because you should be asleep. So here you go, be cold.
Yes.
And then the problem with that is if I warm up, I pass out. Like, so it's like freezing or asleep is my choice. And, you know, there's certain times like when you're driving home late at night on the highway from a late night flight, you're like, no, I think now is just a time to be cold, not a time to be asleep. That's what I'm going to go for right now. Well, I insta-stalked you. And you posted a lot more than you led me to believe you were going to post.
I didn't post at all. Matt posted all that stuff.
Oh, did he really?
Yeah, I had texting, and so I would text him things, and he posted. I did not get on media at all.
Some of it was very clearly Matt.
Yeah.
And then some of it, I was like, no, it sounded like your voice. So.
Yeah, sometimes I would, like, text him, and I would say, like, here's for IG, and I would, like, say something, but I was just only texting him the whole time on my trip, which I cannot remember a time since before high school when computers did not exist in my world that I have like completely disconnected like that. And I mean, technically I didn't completely disconnect because, I was texting Matt, but I removed email from my phone. I did not have like data on my phone. I could only connect if we went to like a restaurant or a cafe that had Wi-Fi, and then I would just post photos on my personal Facebook, and because a lot of friends and family were like asking to see updates, but I like never got on social media, and I didn't check email, and my team and Matt like totally took care of everything, and the world did not come to a crashing halt. Like, nothing got ruined. Everything was fine. And it was really good for my psyche to let go of control and see that, like, you know, everything was fine. And I came home and I, like, immediately, within 12 hours, removed all notifications from my phone because it was, like, immediate stress. Like, it was crazy how I felt when I picked up my phone and it was, like, full of notifications. And before, my phone would just constantly, like, have red circles and, like, all of these notifications on the lock screen, and people would look at my phone and they'd be like, I don't know how you can deal with that. It would stress me out. And I'd be like, oh, it's just life. You know, I'm like, I gotta know. And I couldn't, I like removed it. So, I'm hoping that my mind can stay in a little bit of that vacation mode forever, 'cause I think it'll be really good for me and my stress levels and health in general to
somehow call that, like, technology balance mode.
Yeah.
Like, you're using the technology, not the other way around type.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I don't have very many notifications on my phone. And it's, I mean, and even the ones that are on there, I pretty much ignore. Yeah, so I don't pay much attention to it. It's like, it's there when I look at it. And granted, it's in my pocket, so I do look at it probably more often than I need to. But yeah, I'm a person who needs focus in my life. So I don't like multitasking, other than, you know, maybe talking on the phone while I'm cooking in the kitchen, or, you know, listening to an audiobook or something while I'm cooking, or listening to something while I'm driving. But I don't like, you know, trying to, you know, research for my new book or a new article while I'm handling social media and checking my email. Like, I just, like, I want to just have my time. I call it sort of time batching. So it's, you know, well, now I'm just going to check my email for 10 minutes and do what I can do in 10 minutes. And now I'm going to spend 20 minutes on social media. And now I'm going to just have an hour where nothing else is going to interrupt me and I'm going to write. And when I started doing that, gosh, probably like 2 years ago now, it was sort of right when all of the other things, my audience got big enough that it was frequent, right? The notifications were actually getting to actually interrupt things. And I started just going, okay, like, no, clearly this doesn't work. Like, I can't, I'm not switching back and forth between writing and, you know, replying to a Facebook message fast enough. So I need to figure that out. So I just do one for a while and then I do the other for a while. And I definitely noticed that when I have that focus time, I get way more done in that focus time. And so I can do, if I spend, you know, 10 minutes on social media and 20 minutes of writing, so that for that half hour time commitment, I get double as much done as if I tried to do both of those things at the same time for half an hour. So it's interesting because it's actually, this is totally not relevant to our topic today, but it's becoming a very, like, a studied thing about the more we try to multitask, the less effective we get at each task. And there's really interesting scientific studies actually showing how the internet and social media is actually, like, eroding our ability to stay on task and to focus and actually pay attention to things. And it's basically giving us all, like, a little bit of ADHD because it's training our brains to not stay on task. And so there's this new thing that's called unitasking, as opposed to multitasking, which is, you know, where they're starting to, like, even incorporate it into some, like, school curriculums and stuff, where it's trying to encourage people to take pride in unitasking as opposed to multitasking. Because if you remember growing up, multitasking was like a badge of honor. Like, look at all the things I can do at once.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, yeah. talked about this a little bit before, and I think there's, I still think there's value in both, but it's learning like what works for you when to optimize, you know, how your brain works. And I think being able to identify productive or non-productive periods, I think, you know, doing email while doing other things is a really good example. And, you know, for me, I get somewhere around 200 emails a day just for my work, and not including like probably close to 50 to 100 for the paleo blog stuff a day. And a lot of that is not stuff that I need to actually do or respond to or whatever. It's like, you know, I don't want to say it's junk mail, but it's stuff that like I don't have an action for. But if I'm in the middle of doing something and I hear like a ping for an email and then it pulls me out of what I'm doing and I go check it immediately, then I'm less productive than like this batch thing that you're talking about, versus the multitasking that does work really well for me of like checking social media when I use the restroom. Because yeah, that's that is, so I think like learning your yeah. own like efficiencies is really important. And it was just interesting for me because I didn't associate, like you said, those notifications are in the background and they don't stress you out, and you know that like they're not that important. A lot of this stuff was stuff that I felt the same way about, like, well, I don't need to be affected by these social media notifications. I'll get to it when I get to it. But the immediate stress that like I felt when I saw those notifications for the first time in a week and a half was eye-opening for me, because I hadn't associated them with stress before. I just had associated them with like, oh, I'll do that later. But evidently in my brain, that meant I have to do something later and that's stressful. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Anyway, just.
That's a very cool insight.
Learn to listen to your body. I think it's what we've been talking about for almost 200 episodes.
Yeah. We need to start thinking about what kind of party we're going to throw for number 200.
Oh, goodness. Right now, the only party I can muster is like a blanket party. Everybody just wrap yourselves up in a blanket and snuggle. That's all I can muster right now.
All right. Well, why don't we have been doing this series on weight loss topics. It just so happens that there was quite a lot of new science that was really important on weight loss topics. And so we decided to kind of put all of these together into a series. So we're now going to talk about another study that actually has been fairly controversial. The study itself is not controversial. The results are not what some people wanted to hear, and some people are getting very defensive about the results, which I think is an interesting thing. I actually wrote an article on my website, like 2 weeks ago now, called Everything Causes Cancer. And it was sort of inspired by a segment on John Oliver's Last Week Tonight, where he talked about how scientific studies are presented in the media. But it was a topic that I had wanted to cover on my website for quite a while, of just, you know, how do we interpret science and what can we learn from different types of scientific studies? What can we learn from an epidemiological study versus an animal study? What's the insight we can actually get? And, you know, when we're talking about, certainly there are some studies where we take the results with a grain of salt, but what's happening now, I think, is we're getting so inundated with this new study says something super exciting in the media. And we're getting so inundated with websites that, or other sort of outlets that use science, but in a sometimes intentional and sometimes just, very unintentional, but are using the scientific studies that support an opinion to say, look, I've got this science-founded opinion, without presenting the whole story. And as a consumer, right, as somebody who's just looking for good information and maybe doesn't have a science background, it can be really hard to separate out a biased article or a pseudoscience article versus a more fair treatment, unless you're looking at something that's like super thorough and really presents both sides and is like really obviously like, oh, here it all is. And so I'd sort of talked about that. And it was right at the same time as the results from this scientific study had come out. They were presented as a poster at a scientific conference, and the actual paper is coming out in a couple of months. And I saw that same sort of almost like an anti-science response of, this doesn't support what I believe to be true, therefore it must be bad science. And what's fascinating about this study, it was actually designed to be the, you know, best controlled like study to finally conclusively test the carbohydrate insulin hypothesis of obesity. The lead researcher was Dr. Kevin Hall, and it was funded by a very large grant from the Nutrition Science Initiative, which was founded by some pretty amazing people from the alternative health community in order to fund research that is at this super high level of nutrition research, super high level of really, you know, super controlling, you know, the data so that we can finally get definitive answers. One of the limitations with a lot of nutrition studies is they're often done with what are called callback surveys, so people, or recall surveys, so people think about, what did I eat yesterday? Which I don't know. Can you remember? I mean, oh no, I'm asking the jet lagged woman. That's bad. I'm not going to ask you what you ate yesterday.
I'd have to go to Instagram.
I would have probably a pretty hard time remembering how much of every single thing that I ate yesterday. And so, you know, we know that these types of studies have this major flaw that either people have a hard time remembering or they don't want to admit to eating something. Like, I don't want to admit that I ate whatever it is, box of Oreo cookies or whatever somebody ate, that they don't want to tell the researcher, right? But what you eat influences the results. And so these studies that have been designed, I mean, the only way to really thoroughly control them in humans is to have somebody come and live in an institution where everything is controlled. They're basically locked in, and everything is measured. People watch them eat. if they have guests, their guests have to be searched for like contraband food. They're very, very expensive, very, very labor intensive studies to run. And there's not a lot of government grant funds like the National Institutes of Health or NIH, which funds a very large majority of the medical research that happens in America. So that's why NUSI was created, to help fund this type of really fundamental, groundbreaking, super important research so that it could be done. So this was a $40 million study. So that's something that it went through so many different different stages in its design to make sure that it would be the definitive study to test the carbohydrate and insulin hypothesis. And what that is it comes from this idea that eating a lot of simple carbohydrates, so eating a lot of sugars, increases insulin, and that basically turns on signaling that increases fat storage and slows down your metabolism. And there's this idea that the reason why low carbohydrate and ketogenic diets work is, in the absence of carbohydrates, your insulin drops and you basically turn on all of this fat burning machinery. So you become fat adapted. I'm using air quotes there because I detest the term fat adapted. So you become fat adapted and your metabolism speeds up and you just burn through all this fat. And there's definitely advocates of low carb, very low carb and ketogenic diets who say you can eat more calories than you normally do and still lose weight because of this metabolic advantage of not making very much insulin. And so this study was designed to test that. And what they did was they had 17 overweight or class one obese men live in an institution for 8 weeks. They spent the first 4 weeks on a tightly controlled diet of sort of a standard American diet. So it was actually a pretty, you know, what is considered the average macronutrient breakdown for people. So 50% carbohydrates, half of those carbohydrates were sugar, 15% protein and 35% fat. And then they did 4 weeks on a ketogenic diet. So 5% carbohydrates, the exact same 15% protein and then 80% fat. So it was just a switch from 50, you know, the carbohydrates all switched to fat, protein stayed the same. And they spent 2 days out of every week in a metabolic chamber to measure their exact metabolic rate and energy expenditure. And their diets were completely honed in per individual to be isocaloric. So exactly match their how much energy they were burning. And what was actually really interesting was the researchers discovered that the people were moving around more outside of the chamber than they were in, like, the chamber is just a room. So they have to spend 2 straight days in a room. And clearly, even when, you know, the amount of actual activity time was controlled, so like time on a treadmill in the room was the same as time on a treadmill out of the room, just walking with a little bit more space meant that they were actually burning 300 calories a day more outside of the chamber than inside the chamber. So even though the intent for the study was to be exactly isocaloric, they ended up having a 300 calorie a day deficit, but that was consistent for the entire period of the study. So they ended up with a 300 calorie a day deficit following their standard American diet 4 weeks, and then they had a 300 calorie deficit on their ketogenic diet 4 weeks. So, you know, 300 calorie a day deficit is enough to lose some weight, and they did. And so what they did was they actually measured a body composition. They did it with a DEXA scan, so like the most rigorous and accurate way to measure body composition. And they looked at how much they looked at metabolic rate, energy expenditure, how much metabolic rate while sleeping, and body weight and fat mass in these volunteers. And what they found was that there was a little bit of weight loss in the first 4 weeks on the standard American diet because there was a slight caloric deficit. And so they were losing, you know, a half a pound a week, which I think is somewhere in that range of fat, which was pretty consistent with what you would expect for that caloric deficit. What was really interesting was when they switched from the standard American diet to the ketogenic diet, they lost total weight at about double the rate. So they're all of a sudden that the scale drops, but the amount that was fat actually slowed down. So they were losing water and lean body mass. And, you know, when you're trying to aim for sustainable weight loss, the idea is to preserve your lean body mass, to preserve your muscle, because that is, your muscle is your metabolic machinery. That's what keeps your basal metabolic rate up. That's what, you know, is correlated with health, allows you to be active, gives you energy, right? Like, having muscle is a really amazing thing. So when we are trying to lose weight, you know, the goal is to preserve as much lean body mass as possible while losing fat. And so what the ketogenic diet actually did in this study was the complete opposite of what people's goals are when they are losing weight. They were losing not as much fat as if they just followed, you know, a standard American diet type macronutrient ratios, and they lost more lean body mass and more, and water. And what was fascinating too was, you know, the study was 4 weeks long, which is considered ample time to become fat adapted on the ketogenic diet. And that was designed to be that long in order to address that specific concern that the researchers knew was going to come up. And they actually showed a very tiny, slight increase in metabolism the first week on the ketogenic diet, and then it went away. So for 1 week on the ketogenic diet, these people were burning about 100 calories a day more than they had been the week before on the standard American diet. And then they became adapted to the ketogenic diet and their metabolisms started to slow down again. And so they just had, and it didn't slow down, you know, to a worse level. Their energy expenditure just went back to what it had been with that 300 calorie a day deficit on the standard American diet. So this study, which, you know, was done with enough people to have really, really tight statistics, really, really powerful statistical analysis, and was super uber controlled, is really, really fascinating because it sort of busts a myth that's been around now for several decades, 30 years, probably. I mean, I can't remember when Atkins diet first came out, but this, I mean, this definitely goes back to the 90s, if not to the late 80s, of this idea of low carbohydrate diets give you this metabolic advantage and you can lose weight without the caloric deficit. But what's fascinating is this is in tandem with other studies that showed that the same number of calories on a low carbohydrate diet are more satiating than a standard American diet. Which I think this is one of the reasons why people lose weight on paleo is because we are honing in on the most nutrient dense foods and they're also the most satiating foods. So we feel full in a very, you know, balanced proportional way to what we're eating. And so it's sort of different, you know, the criticisms of this study have been, well, I lost all this weight on a low carb diet. What this study is saying is like, it's not saying that low carb diets don't work for losing weight. They are saying that you might do better with a different approach. But they're saying that the reason why a low carbohydrate diet or a ketogenic diet helps with weight loss is because of the focus on more satiating calories and this natural energy deficit that occurs. So you just end up eating less because you're eating within this framework. And you're not trying to eat less, you're not counting calories, but that's just what ends up happening. And that's why you lose weight. And I found this fascinating because you probably remember that I lost, my journey to paleo involved losing 100 pounds on a low carbohydrate diet while getting less and less healthy and needing a better solution. And then finding paleo and finding, you know, health and weight loss maintenance at the same time. And I used to even back then say, you know, I think it's just a tricky way to cut down calories without counting calories. Like I used to like, when I would think about how many calories I was eating with, you know, a chicken salad for lunch, I'm like, this is less than if I was eating a sandwich. Like just, I sort of intuitively knew that it was an easy way to achieve a caloric deficit compared to counting calories, but not eating filling foods. So it's been a very fascinating study. Did you get a chance to look at it?
I was in Europe. No, I did not get a chance to look at it.
All the hubbub of the people.
There was no hubbub for me because there was no people.
There was no internet.
There were ancient ruins and no internet. Yeah. So, but you know what? It doesn't surprise me at all. I think kind of where you're coming from. I do think that there are plenty of studies out there, and I think we would be remiss to mention that eating a refined carbohydrate, high sugar diet has been proven to cause unhealthy things, but it's not necessarily associated with weight loss, right? So I think, you know, the idea that a high refined carbohydrate load, especially with foods that are white, and I'm using air quotes there, right? Like white flour, white sugar, those kinds of things have been, there are plenty of studies out there that show how that leads to, you know, insulin response and, you know, diabetes, type 2 diabetes, obviously, those kinds of things. So it's not, I don't want people to hear what you're saying and
Say free for all on sugar. Absolutely not.
Right.
So So to put this in broader context, there's been a very large number of studies that have sort of pitted low carb versus low fat versus a calorie control like Weight Watchers or Jenny Craig, which basically boiled down to counting calories, and have basically shown, you know, you'll get some studies will show, oh, well, low fat's a little bit better, or another study shows, oh, low carb's a little bit better. But most of them basically show they're all about the same, and it doesn't really matter what diet you do for weight loss. What matters most is that you are being cognizant of what you are putting in your mouth, and that you have some kind of framework from which to choose foods. But that's a little bit different than saying what's the healthiest way to lose weight. And I think that, you know, we know that, you know, if you're trying to just count calories and you're eating a lot of junk, A, it's very, very hard to maintain because of the nutrient deficits that happen when you're not eating nutrient dense foods. And nutrient deficits can cause cravings and can increase hunger and disrupt sleep, which then does the same thing. Like it's a pretty vicious cycle.
And create the long-term health issues that we addressed on the first of the series regarding the Biggest Loser article too.
Exactly. So what this is really showing is that, you know, it's not that low carb diets are not a useful weight loss tool. And I think that, you know, depending on exactly how they're implemented with a nutrient focus, you know, they can be a way for people to sustainably reduce their caloric intake without feeling like they're counting or they're, you know, the problem with feeling like you're counting is that it's, emphasizes any kind of feeling of deprivation. And so it can be a good strategy there, but I think it also really reinforces the idea that, we need to have that caloric deficit. There's dozens, if not hundreds of studies that say this, you need to have an energy deficit to lose weight. That is a mandatory condition. And it's different than saying weight loss is all about calories in and calories out, because clearly things like insulin regulation and leptin regulation and ghrelin regulation and neurotransmitters and cortisol and thyroid hormones and estrogen and progesterone and testosterone, these are all factors, adiponectin. I mean, there's just so many hormones that are controlling how our bodies respond to exercise, how they respond to different diets, have, you know, different caloric intakes, and how willing our body is to burn stored fuel compared to freshly consumed fuel. But it's still, if you want to lose weight, you cannot lose weight by eating more calories, with the very notable exception of somebody who is under eating to the point of creating starvation signals in their bodies, which is a very different situation. That is the one situation where you can lose weight by increasing more calories. But it really, you know, it's not as simple as count my calories in and then hop on the treadmill for 3 hours in the evening because I ate that piece of chocolate cake for lunch. But it does mean we need to be cognizant of things like portion size. Like that is part of, if weight loss is a goal, that is part of achieving that goal.
I think it all comes down to something that I heard really early on in paleo, and I haven't really heard anybody talk about it since. I believe it was Stephen Guinet, and I'm not even sure like what he's up to anymore, and I apologize if I'm giving him credit and it was someone else that said it, but I believe it was the very first AHS, he did a speech about palatability of food. And that's really, like, for me, what I try to focus on and what I think about is this idea that it's difficult to overeat on chicken and broccoli because they're not highly palatable. But if you're consuming something that, you know, is high in sugar, fats, salt, or any combination of those things, then, you know, especially if you're if you have a history of overeating, as most people who are overweight have in some capacity overeaten, because that's how you, you know, ended up with additional calories, then you're more likely to consume more of those foods than you would if they were less palatable. And so this idea of, you know, portion control isn't a word that I like. It's just, for me, coming from a history of disordered eating, like this idea of portion control and counting calories is something that really, you know, doesn't resonate with me personally. But what really resonates with me is this idea of focusing on nutrient-dense foods that are not highly palatable, so that, you know, my body doesn't say, ooh, I want more of that thing that was delicious versus I want more of X, Y, or Z. And it's also why once I have something that's highly palatable, my body has a difficult time like moving on. You know, if I have cake for my birthday, or, you know, like this trip, I had gelato, right? And so for me coming back, it's really difficult to jump on the, okay, I want to be clean paleo and focus on, you know, recovery and healing and whatever from being on a trip, because my brain is like, no, no, we want more gelato. We don't want soup. So I think, you know, whatever context works for people, it's just important to realize that, you know, if you're eating those foods that are, you know, nutrient dense, they're usually not the ones that are highly palatable. And there are some exceptions to that. Like obviously pink salt is something that, you know, is advantageous, but also, helps things to be palatable. But for the most part, I find that to be the case. Did you ever, hear that talk? Am I giving wrong credit?
I can't remember if it was Stephen Guinea, but I've heard many different variations of that talk. I've heard it differentiated as, palatable versus hyper palatable. So, yeah. You know, like you still get to eat tasty food, right? Steak is just delicious. But it's not the same as a chocolate dipped potato chip.
Exactly.
Like, right. So, there's foods that are so hyper palatable that they're addictive versus foods that are just darned tasty, but are super nutrient dense and are going to, you know, fuel your body in a really healthful way. And so I think that's the line. And I think it's kind of a blurry line. I know there are foods that hit those same food addiction buttons for me that, other people can eat and be like, not have that issue with. So I think there's a bit of an individual response here. I mean, I do have a history of morbid obesity and binge eating disorder and food addiction. So, I almost certainly have some, extra brain circuitry for food reward systems. But I think that that's, you know, another amazing power to the paleo diet is that it cuts out those foods, unless you're, you know, actively trying to create a paleo adaptation of your favorite chocolate dipped potato chip. You know, you can create hyper palatable foods within a paleo template, but the sort of run of the mill paleo doesn't include those. So I think that, that's how I've heard it framed, sort of hyper palatable versus just tasty.
So the only other thing that I want to add to this show before we close up the series, is that while I was gallivanting in Europe, Matt informed me, again, I haven't read it, but we'll put a link in the show notes, that there was an article that came out about one of the Biggest Losers saying that they were given additional items such as ephedrine while on the ranch. So in addition to the show that launched this series where we talked about what happened to those contestants, I don't want to suppose whether or not this accusation is founded or not, but it's interesting that one of the contestants has come forth and said that they were given essentially speed and identified several of the trainers and the different kinds of things that they were given. And obviously, Sarah, we don't need to go into the science, but that affects their bodies and their hormones and would speak a lot to how their metabolism would rebound on the back end as well. So we will put a link in the show notes and you can check that out on your own. I just, because we do this show current with what's happening in the media and everything that's out there, I wanted to make sure that if that was something that you were interested in, that you didn't miss the follow-up story as it continues to unfold that started the series.
I'm going to go check out that article right now.
Awesome. Well, thank you for sharing this scientific study with us, even though it doesn't necessarily, as you said, support what we all, well, maybe not all of us.
It's certainly not something that would change the way we do paleo, but I think that there's a fairly large faction of very devoted low-carbers and ketogenic dieters within the paleo community. They're the ones who are very angry about this study, of course. But I think it's really important for our listeners because we've got some smart listeners and they get their information in a lot of different places. And so I think it's really important to provide the more balanced, here's what the science actually says, so that, people can, get educated and make the best choices for them. I mean, that's what this is all about, right?
Definitely. So it's good to be back stateside. I am going to reacclimate to life. And, I will be back to posting my own social media so that the ones that are obviously met will be me. And I'm going to try to post something on the blog at some point about my trip, specifically how I, navigated food in Europe. And I will, anyway, so check out the blog if that's something that you're interested in. But nevertheless, thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening.
Did you see the picture?
Did you want to start?
Yeah. Did you see the picture of the thing that Matt printed out for me that, told me how to say no gluten, corn, or tomatoes? I'm just going to, do a blog post and post that and be like, just have Matt make this for you. You'll be good. All right, hold on. Let me start a new show.
Matt has a new part-time job.
Google Translator. He'll charge you $50 to type something into Google Translator. Okay, hold on. Let me start a new show.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
I'm not hearing anything, Stacey.
You can't hear me? Hey, Matt!
That's weird. Did you just talk?